Thank you, Nana. And hi, everyone. I am Cora Louise Belford, and I am a grateful, recovering alcoholic. I'm honored to be with you this afternoon, and you may not know it, but I feel that you are welcoming me home. I grew up in Greenville, Mississippi. I married in 1939 and moved to Georgia. And during the war, we lived in various places, and when my husband came home from overseas in 1946, we moved to New York to live 1 year. And we've been there ever since, until April 1st, when we both had retired from our jobs and moved back to the Mississippi Delta, to Leland instead of Greenville, because I have a lot of family living in Leland. And it feels wonderful to be home again and to be here with all of you. This is the third Mississippi State Convention that you've been kind enough to invite me to. And I've been down here various other times on visits so that I feel that I know many of you. And before long, I hope I will know every single one of you. I want to thank you, Nina, for the kind things you said. And I want to share my favorite introduction that I ever had when I was speaking at a meeting of this kind. A few years ago, I was invited to a roundup in Maryville, Tennessee. And I was to be the Sunday morning speaker at the spiritual meeting. And this darling girl had met me in the airport in Knoxville the day before. And she'd shown me around and been so kind and so attentive. And she was sort of new in the program. And she was given the job of introducing me on Sunday morning, and this is what she said. She said, last year I was brand new, and they asked me to go to Knoxville to meet the New York speaker. And I went expecting some New York floozy to get off the plane. And instead, the sweetest little lady that you would ever want to meet, that was Hazel, J.P. remembers her well, got off the plane. And she said, this year they sent me back. And the floozy that I was expecting to get off the plane last year got off the plane this year. I had just come back from visiting my daughter who was living in Hawaii. And I had flown directly from Honolulu to Chicago to Knoxville. And my daughter had insisted that I buy a proper Honolulu dress, and it was all colorful, and I had a yellow bow in my hair and yellow shoes on. And from that time on, I've always traveled in a navy blue dress. I'm always glad when a meeting begins with a reading of how it works, because it reminds me once again that we seek spiritual progress, not spiritual perfection in this program. And believe me, I have had reason to fall back on that in these last few months. I retired from my job at our AA World Service office in New York last September, and we moved the 1st of April, and a whole lot of changes took place in my life. I had worked at GSO for 14 years, and I was used to being terribly busy and terribly involved, and I didn't realize how dependent I had become on the kind of outpouring love and stroking that we all get in AA. I still had my own group, but it wasn't quite the same thing as what I had been used to in the World Service Office. And suddenly, after 34 years, I had to pull up stakes and move from a very large city to a very small city. And that's a blessing, because no way am I tempted to compare Leland to New York. I know they're not the same, and I don't expect that. And I was telling some of the people that I was having lunch with that the kind of thing that I had to do in this move brought together every one of my character defects, of which I still have plenty. Progress, not perfection, I hope. But I like to plan things, and I like to know what's going to happen and when it's going to happen, and I like things to be organized. And I found out that I like for people to do what I wanted to do. And everybody's doing his own thing. And I was not only powerless over alcohol, I was powerless over the painters, and I was powerless over the carpenters, and I was powerless over the moving van, and I was powerless over my husband, and I was powerless over everybody I was dealing with, and I was powerless over me. And my life became unmanageable until I realized what had happened. And I had to let go of some of these things and let what happened happen instead of trying to make it happen the way that I like to do. I have a new sponsor since I've moved to Leland, and he's made a vast difference in my life. In New York, we always said that the women should sponsor women and the men should sponsor men, but I think I can have a young man for my sponsor because he is my nephew. And he has been in the program quite as long as I have, but he is really making me think. He is keeping me on the ball. He's getting me to a lot of meetings. And not only that, he's making it all a lot of fun for me. And he brought me down here today, and because I was worried about being on time, he even got a ticket from the top for coming too fast. I feel that I am one of the luckiest AAs that ever lived. I never took a drink after my first meeting, no credit to me. This is strictly the grace of God and the fellowship. I did bring the body, and I brought it regularly. And I say that I had my slips before I got here. After I had been sober 8 years, I went to work in our World Service office. And I looked forward to this with interest, but I never had any idea what I was getting in for when I took this job. I had the opportunity to travel all over this country and Canada and meet AA people like you everywhere. And I had the marvelous opportunity of participating in the sharing of experience, strength, and hope of AA worldwide, because that's really what our World Service Office is. A storehouse of the shared experiences of AA groups and members all over the world ever since the very beginning of this fellowship. Everything we have came about as a result of the shared experiences of AA members. The 12 steps represented the shared experiences of the earliest members. The 12 traditions represented the shared experiences of the earliest groups. And the 12 concepts for world service represented the experience of AA as it came of age after it was some 20 years old. To have been involved in all of this and with all of you during these years was the greatest blessing that ever came my way, second only to finding sobriety in this fellowship. I miss being at GSO. I miss my friends there. But because of this program and through the grace of God, I am enjoying my new way of life, and I look forward to it day by day and to sharing with all of you as time goes on. Now, I used to talk a lot about the World Service Office when I was still working there. I'm used to doing that, and I like to do that. But I know that when you invite a speaker to come and speak at a convention, what you really want to hear is their story. What happened, how it is now, and this is what I never miss an opportunity to tell, because this is the story of the transforming experience of my life. Before I arrived in AA and during my drinking years, I became the kind of woman that I never wanted to be. Destructive, irrational, unpredictable. Thanks to this program and to the grace of God, day by day, I think I have at least begun the process, which I hope is still going on, of trying to become a different kind of person. I hope in the process of telling you this story, I'll be able to express in any way at all the real depth of my gratitude for AA. To AA, for making it possible for me to begin this new way of life. I began to drink with any kind of regularity, sort of late in life for an alcoholic. I was 26 years old, married and the mother of two little girls before drinking was anything but a very occasional experience for me. And almost from the very beginning, I know now, drinking had a different significance for me from what it had with the people that I drank with. During World War II, when my husband was overseas, I took it big, like I took everything, and like I'm still inclined to be, take it big. And I suffered a lot because my husband was overseas and I was left alone at home with the care of these two little girls. And I spent my time being anxious and uptight and worried. And I moved to Suwanee, where my mother had a house, after my husband went away. And I discovered there a lot of other war widows like me. And we used to get together in the afternoon and turn the children loose in the sand pile and on the swing. And we would sit on the porch and share our experience, strength, and hope with each other through a few drinks. And I thought this was wonderful. And I found that I began to look forward to this time of day. And I began to associate all experiences of fun and relaxation with those times that I drank. Now, I don't think the other women that I drank with felt this way about it. Even if I had known that drinking was, that my drinking was different or that its significance was different, I don't think it would really have made any difference to me as long as I was able to handle it well in fairly large amounts. And like a lot of alcoholics, I had an enormous capacity in the beginning. And I was terribly proud of this. Little did I know how bad I was going to need that hollow leg as time went on. When we used to go on picnics, they used to say, who's going to drive the car home? So they're going to take a keg of beer or something like this. And they would say, oh, Cora, we'd never get tight. Let her drive. And I felt 10 feet tall. You know, when they gave me the driver's license, they expected that I would be able to handle the machine. But this seemed significant to me that I was able to drink as much as they did and never get tight. When my husband came home from overseas, I had childlike and unrealistic expectations. I thought the fairy godmother would wave a wand over us and that we would live happily ever after and that this was the end of all my problems. And it didn't quite work out that way. He had been overseas with the 5th Marine Division and I had been home with two little children. And we'd had very different kinds of experiences. And we were not getting along too well. After we'd been home for a few months, we moved to New York. And after about a year in New York, I developed a symptom. I shook all the time. This was not as a result of drinking. I still was not drinking alcoholically. I just shook. I couldn't sign my name. I couldn't hold a cup of coffee. And it really was interfering a great deal with my life. So I went to see a doctor, and I went through a whole battery of tests. And they decided that I had floating anxiety and that I needed to go to see a psychotherapist. And I didn't like this idea at all. We had problems, but I was the one they were sending to the shrink. Well, in 1947, not every other person I knew was going to a psychotherapist. The only people that I knew who were going to psychotherapists were crazy. And I wasn't quite prepared to admit to that state yet. Later on, I got prepared to admit to that state. I really did want to make a go of this marriage. I really did want to learn to be a good mother to my children. And so I agreed to go. And after 18 months of what had been very successful treatment, according to the therapist, I went to a party one night, drank in the usual manner and in the usual amount, only this time I had a very peculiar experience. I got terribly drunk for the first time in my life, and I had a blackout, and I was not prepared for either one of these things. I had always taken a rather formidable attitude toward drinking. I thought that if one could not drink well, one couldn't drink at all. Well being how I drank. You can see I had a long way to fall from this lofty perch. I had never even heard of a blackout at this time.
It happened that I had fallen down a flight of steps and landed on my head on a stone terrace in my drunken trace the night before. And I thought I had a concussion. And that's why I didn't remember anything. I was too ashamed of the cause of the fall to go to a regular doctor about it. But I did discuss it with the therapist. And in innocence, he said all the things that I wanted to hear. He told me that this was the kind of thing that could happen to anyone occasionally. That in my case, he felt sort of encouraged. He thought it was a good sign that finally at least the alcohol was able to break through this armor. But he did suggest that until we resolved some very difficult problems that we were handling, that perhaps I should be careful about any drinking I did for a while. And I agreed with him wholeheartedly. I did not want to have an experience like that again. And I set out to be careful. And I tried every way that I could think of to be careful. And I tried every way that anybody could suggest to me to be careful. The trouble was, of course, that I didn't know it, my family didn't know it, the therapist didn't know it. I had already lost the ability to be careful. None of us knew that drinking had already become the imperative factor in my life. None of us, and by that I don't mean that I was drunk every day, or even that I got drunk every single time I drank. What I mean is that the question of to drink or not to drink, what to drink, where to drink, when to drink, with whom to drink, these questions motivated practically everything that I did. None of us knew that I had already reached the point of no return as far as drinking is concerned. I had already crossed that famous invisible line that separates people who can drink successfully from those who can't. Now, I'm perfectly free to admit that if I had known any of that, I simply would not have been able to accept it at that time. I would not have been able to believe that I had been licked by a thing like these. And I most heartily did believe, and in this I had the support of my family and my therapist and most people who knew me well, that if I could only find the key, it would unlock the door and emancipate me, emancipate what everyone used to refer to as the real me. If I could only do that, I would be able to get some order in my life again, and that in that order, drinking would fall into its proper place. And so I set out to get some order in my life. I set out to find this will-o'-the-wisp known as the real me. And I endowed this fantastic church with every ounce of energy and imagination and resource that I had. And this is considerable. I continued to look for it in psychotherapy. The therapist could hardly be expected to help me with a problem that I categorically refused to discuss with him. I planned to discuss it. I wanted to discuss it. The night before I was going to see him, I would write lists of the things that I was going to tell him. I needed to talk about it. I wanted to talk about it, and I simply could not. The only time that I could talk about my drinking was when I was drunk, and when I was drunk, nobody wanted to talk to me about anything. I would be on the subway or in a taxi cab on my way to his office, and I would fall into such a state of chaos and terror that I would have to go there and make up some tale that would describe the condition that I was in. The only way I found out what he thought about alcoholism was to discuss my brother's case with him. And he told me what he thought. He thought what most people thought at that time. That drinking was a symptom of an underlying personality problem, and that if you could clear up these emotional conflicts and difficulties, that you would be able to drink again in a normal way. And I bought it. That's what I wanted to hear. And I continued in psychotherapy for 9 years. I don't mean going to group therapy. I don't mean going to see this man once a week. I went to see him 3 and 4 times a week, summers included, for 9 years.
The first 18 months were before I began to drink alcoholically. The last 18 months, really, there was not much anybody could do to help me, in psychotherapy at least. I never showed up drunk, but I showed up so befuddled and like, he knew what was going on, but he was the kind of therapist who was non-directive. I had to speak to him about it. He was not going to mention it to me. I don't blame him for not being able to help me with this problem, and I'm grateful to this man, because he held me together somehow until I finally could find my way to AA and to all of you. I sought for my answers in books and study. I was always running off to Columbia University or to NYU to take a course, thinking that if I could only learn how other people had coped with their problems and gained wisdom, that I would be able to apply some of this to myself. But I didn't find any cases just like mine. I could always say yes, but to everything that I heard and everything that I learned. I looked for it in worthy causes. I thought if I could only find something that was bigger than I was, that I could throw myself into, then I would care about that, and then I wouldn't drink so much. But I never found anything that big. I sought for my answers in domesticity and home life. My house hasn't ever been so clean. I wasn't able to clean up anything on the inside, so everything outside had to be just so all the time. I've never given so many parties, except elaborate ones. It's true that people would frequently show up at a party that I would have forgotten I had invited them to. And it's true that sometimes we'd have to get the food up off the floor before we could get it on the table. But I've continued to make these efforts in this direction. I sought for answers in my religion, which I had turned my back on entirely. But I went back to church with the wrong idea. I had it all backwards. I went there to make sure that the higher power understood what my will for me was. I had to come here to find out that it was the other way around. And I even sought for my answers at Ebbets Field in the days when the Dodgers were still in Brooklyn. And there was a method in this. This was the way I was trying to cope with my drinking. I was a great baseball fan, and I loved the Dodgers. My husband says I was not a fan, that I was a fiend. And I thought, if I had to get on the subway in New York and go to Brooklyn 7 to 7 times every summer and get myself home 7 to 7 times every summer, that I wouldn't drink so much, and besides it was healthy out there in the open air and all. So I talked all my family into going together to give me a season ticket to all the Dodger home games. And 77 times every summer I got on the subway and I went to Brooklyn. And somehow I got home from Brooklyn. Because at Ebbets Field, I discovered beer. And the beer vendors discovered me. And when they would come around for the seventh inning stretch, they would automatically leave 4 cans of beer by my chair and say, "Ladies, we hope for your sake that the game doesn't go into extra innings because we're not coming back." At the same time that I was looking in all these places for answers to my problem, I was, of course, always looking in the old reliable place, in the contents of a bottle. And here, in the contents of a bottle, I really did always find the key. But the door that this key unlocked was the door to a Pandora's box. And out of the box came this disgusting, irrational, unpredictable creature that scared everybody to death and scared me to death. I believe what I have heard, and I'm sure you have, in vino veritas, that in wine you speak the truth. And so I thought that the real me was what came out of that bottle, and that all the other things that I did were simply pretense and show and funny, and that it was this horrible thing that came out of this bottle that represented what I really was. And I became hopeless. The gap between this person who made attempts at worthwhile living and this creature who was so obsessed by, who was so
made the step by obsessive and compulsive drinking that she poisoned and tipped over every good thing she did. This gap was too wide to span, I thought, and I could not believe that I would ever find the bridge. The chaos and confusion that were created in my life and in the lives of all those around me by this attempt of mine to live two lives simultaneously, one on a more or less rational plane, and the other on the dark side, finally brought me to the point of despair where nothing seemed worth the effort anymore. And then one day, by the grace of God, I had a moment of truth. I remember this day like yesterday, and I never want to forget it. At about 4 o'clock in the afternoon on the Friday before Labor Day in 1957, I was in my kitchen, and I had postponed taking the first drink as long as I possibly could. When I came into AA, they told me just to postpone it. I knew about that. I had practice at it. Because I knew when I took the first drink, there was no predicting what would happen after that. And so I postponed. Finally, at 4 o'clock, when I absolutely couldn't stand it any longer, I took a drink. And this was an afternoon like any other afternoon, as far as I know. Only I was suddenly overwhelmed by the realization of the helplessness and hopelessness and near despair of my situation. I really hated what they did to me. I had hated it for a very long time, and I was so sick and tired of it all. I got up, and I went to the telephone without a thought in my head, and I called my husband. He could always tell if I had had one drink. I never knew how he could do that, but I do now. Because with the first drink, I was already getting low. There was this manic quality, this excitement. I'm on my way. I've had the first, and another one's coming up. And he could hear this in my voice long before I was tired at all. This time, he didn't have to guess. I said, I know I will be drunk when you come home tonight. Please try not to be angry with me, because I hope it will be the last night. And then from out of the blue came the words that subsequently changed my life. I said, if you will call AA and find out where their meetings are, I'm willing to give it a shot. I don't know whether I'm an alcoholic or not. I know if I am, it isn't my fault, but it would be my fault if I don't try to find out and do something about it. We know it's helped a lot of people with the booze problem, and it doesn't cost a thing, so what have I got to lose? What did I have to lose? What an irony that turned out to be. Only those things I had been struggling to get rid of all those years. And what did I have to find? Those things that I had been looking for such a long time in so many unlikely places. The week before that Friday afternoon, I had called up the children's pediatrician, who was a good friend and a neighbor, and asked him to come over and talk to me about a problem that I was having with one of the children. They were away for the summer, but they were about to come home. And he and his wife came. I was not drunk when they arrived, but I certainly wasn't sober, and I was being a good hostess and pouring rapidly for everybody, more rapidly for me. And in the midst of my conversation with him, he interrupted, and he said, I have to stop you, and I have to say something that's going to make you very angry. And I should have said it a long time ago. He said, I don't think you're going to do anything about this problem that you got, or any other problem that you have, unless you do something about the drinking. It's out of control. I want you to let me call Dr. Reeve Fox. This is a New York psychiatrist who specializes in alcoholism. And I want you to go to see it. And I said, no, I'm not going to see any psychotherapist. No more money is going to be spent on me and my problems. We'll have to find another way. And I was just as mad as he thought I was going to be. And I got rid of him and his wife in a big hurry because the one I was mad at was my husband. I thought he had ratted on me. Now, this man got a medical degree, and I thought he didn't have an eyes and nose and ears. is. I thought my husband had to tell him I was having a problem with drinking. And I tore into my husband. And the week between that doctor's visit and the day that I called my husband on the phone, well, the worst was the worst week that we ever spent. The drinking took on a kind of desperation quality. I had never been hospitalized for drinking, and my husband really told me that he was considering calling the same pediatrician, who was the only doctor we had, to put me into a hospital because he thought I was dangerous to myself, and he knew damn well I was dangerous to him. After I hung up the phone from talking with my husband, having asked him to call AA, the phone rang, and it was that doctor. And he said, "I want to know if you've been thinking about the conversation that you and I had last week." And I said, "This is uncanny." And I told him what had happened. And he said, "You agreed to go to AA?" And I said, "Well, yeah, don't you think I ought to be?" He said, "Well, it's the very best thing you could possibly do. But I wouldn't have dared suggest it. It still bugs me. Why don't they dare suggest it? They suggest everything else in the world to us both. They suggest psychotherapy. They suggest hospitals. They suggest pills. They suggest job interviews. They suggest everything in the world except the thing that works. But it's this. I'm still interested to know what this is." At any rate, I said, "I'm scared to go to this meeting alone. Do you think it would be too childish of me if I asked Lee, that's my husband, to go with me?" And he said, "Oh, no, 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 no. And if Lee doesn't want to go, you let me know, and I'll go with you. Just go." So we hung up the phone, and I felt grand. I was in the dead center of the universe. I had hit the bullet. And after all, I had told my husband that I was going to be drunk when he got home that night. So I did really owe it to myself. And so I took one drink and two drinks and three drinks. And after the fourth drink, I got telephonitis. And I always say I got to AA through the grace of God and telephonitis. Because I got on the telephone and I began to call everybody I knew to tell them about my big decision. And not one single person said, "You don't need that." And the next day, when I came to, and I began to have second thoughts about this big decision of the day before, the phone started ringing. And all those people that I had called were calling to remind me, because they knew I sometimes forgot telephone calls. They were calling to remind me about my big decision. I said, "Gee, thanks a heap." It was Labor Day weekend. I was expecting company, and I had been looking forward to it, because I was expecting drinking company, my kind of people. Well, I knew enough about AA because of my brother and a few other people I knew that you didn't teach people to drink here. The idea was that you stopped drinking. So now the whole damn world knew that I had made this big decision, and so I couldn't take a drink. And I sat there, looking noble and tragic and deprived, drinking water while everybody else swilled down the bourbon. The Tuesday after Labor Day, as my sister was leaving, she said to me, "Honey, you got to find another way, because we can't stand you like this." She left, and the moment of truth had come. I had to go to the meeting, and I spent the rest of the day throwing up. I was terrified. I really was scared to death. I wasn't even sure that I was an alcoholic, in spite of all the evidence to the contrary. None of those things had happened to me that I thought had to happen in order to qualify you as an alcoholic. I'd never been hospitalized for alcoholism. I had never even had a doctor come to take care of me as a result of drinking. I never had even been put on any kind of pills as a result of drinking, thanks be to God. I had never been a morning drinker. I didn't get up in the morning, but I hadn't been a morning drinker. And I held on to that. Alcoholics drank in the morning. I didn't get up, but I didn't drink.
And I didn't drink the first thing when I got up. I told you I need that postponement. I wasn't a binge drinker. I wasn't an around-the-clock drinker. I had even ceased to be a daily drinker in my effort to control some time before coming into AA. I certainly had never been in any trouble with the law. That was luck, and the fact that I was a protected alcoholic. And I hadn't lost a lot as a result of drinking, at least not a lot in a physical sense. I still had my husband and my children. I still had most of the friends that I really cared about. I still had my health. I even still had the price of the next bottle. But I was one of the alcoholics that was guilty of contempt prior to investigation. I just didn't think this was the place for me. I was contemptuous of it some way, to have to go there with all those drunks and listen to them talk. After all those years of psychotherapy and all this help that I've had, what kind of good is that going to do me? But at any rate, I went. And as we walked out of the house that night to go to that meeting, I thought, boy, you've really done enough. You are really about to take a plunge into the darkness. You have lost your way. Little did I know that that plunge was going to turn out to be my leap of faith. That darkness was going to turn out to be better than any light that I had ever known. And the way that I had lost was going to lead me to a way that I had been looking for. But I didn't know any of this when I went to this meeting. I was scared to death. I was bleeding and bruised. And I thought that I was permanently broken in spirit, that the most that I could hope for would be to find a way that I could endure and walk through my life one day at a time. I did not know what was just around the corner. And now when things are bad for me, I remember that day that I thought was the end of my life. And it turned out instead to be the beginning. And our first meeting was at the old Manhattan Group in New York. And it was in a neighborhood which had not been rejuvenated at that time. It was a little scrubby. And I remember thinking, what am I doing in a place like this? And we walked up and down and up and down and up and down in front of that church. And I said to my husband, if I ever needed a drink in my life, I need a drink now. He said, go to the meeting. Let's go to the meeting. And then if you still have to have a drink, we'll get one when we come out. So shaking and miserable, we went inside. And there was a man leading a beginner's meeting. He later became one of our closest friends. I will never forget him. I never turned down an opportunity to do anything that I'm asked to do in AA, because I remember that man who accepted the responsibility of leading the beginners meeting of his group. He didn't know that anything he said that night was going to change the life of one woman, her husband, and those people who were close to her. But he did. And you want to know the brilliant profundity that he came out with? This was the thing that turned the screw and opened the door so that I began to hear. He said, you can't be a little bit alcoholic any more than you can be a little bit pregnant. It's just a question of how far the condition has progressed. And I thought, yeah, that's right. I've not progressed to the point of my brother or some other people I knew, but I could get better. The important thing is not what he said, but the fact that he gained my attention. And for the first time in my life, and some people say the last time, I was able to suspend criticism and analysis and judgment and opinion and instead listen and consequently learn a little bit. And I heard about what you do to stay away from the first drink on a daily basis. And we used to have what we call nickel therapy. I guess it's two-bit therapy now. I heard about having candy bars and making the telephone call first and drinking coffee and going to lots of meetings to support you in the effort. Now, I don't believe I would have believed any of this if I'd read it in a book. I would have thought it was an oversimplification of a complicated problem, and maybe it is. but I will defend to the death the fact that it worked. And that night, AA became for me, and I hope it still is, I know it still is, a kind of school where I began the process of learning the things that I'd always wanted to know, which were how to live a life that had some meaning and purpose. And in all of this, I found the incentive from the example of people like you. I found the tools from your experience. And I found the courage from your unfailing strength and support to begin to be able to face the realities of my own life one day at a time. Now, I don't know how to give thanks for these things. I don't have the words, and I never will. And so I have to try to give at least partial evidence of my gratitude through love and service to this fellowship and to the people in it, who are the ones that showed me the difference between despair and hope, between futility and a kind of fulfillment, between slavery and freedom, really. And I'm going to tell you one more story, and then I'm going to sit down. I failed to tell this story at a meeting one time, and the man who'd asked me came up and grabbed me by the throat and said that was the only reason he had asked me to come, was because he wanted me to tell the story about the dinner party, so I don't dare leave it out. My husband is an Episcopal clergyman, and for many years was chairman of the Department of Religion at New York University. He retired this past September. And a couple of years before I came into AA, he asked if we could have a dinner party for the faculty and staff from his department at NYU. This was not the people from the church, but from the university. And I, of course, consented to do this, and I worked hard to make the party a success. And in the afternoon, about 3 o'clock, I was all through my work, and I was tired. And I thought I'd take a nap before I got dressed for the company at 7. And then I had one of those inspirations that occur with depressing frequency to alcoholics. I thought, I believe I'll have a nice little ladylike glass of sherry to help me relax and get drowsy. Now, I knew a little glass of sherry did not get me drowsy. I knew it took a little bottle or two of sherry to get me drowsy. And I also knew, long before AA, that it was the first drink. The first drink that got me into all the trouble. But I still didn't know anything about how you stay away from the first thing. I thought I could apply a reason to it. And so I applied a good reason. I said, any fool would know enough to be discreet at a time like this. And I took the first thing. You know the rest. I didn't have the luck to pass out. I never did. I didn't have sense enough to leave home. I never did do that either. I showed up at the party, almost falling down drunk, close to hysterics, as I always was when I drank, manic, muttering a stream of what I hoped was incomprehensible gibberish. I say this with feeling because what I was saying was not very complimentary to my husband, and it was not expressed in the language that most people associate with a clergyman's wife. Now, the people at this party, we're Episcopalians, and Episcopalians take a fairly relaxed attitude toward social drinking. This is not to say they were relaxed about my drinking, it's they didn't know it was too social. But the people at this party mostly came from the Midwest. They came from a temperance kind of background. Most of them didn't even smoke. This was the kind of person that I called square. And I spent the evening telling them that at the top of my lungs. Now, you talk about arrogance. Here I was, the boss's wife, clergyman's wife, the hostess, drunk and disorderly. And I had the nerve to refer to these people in what you will conclude were rather difficult circumstances. I had the nerve to refer to them in what I knew and intended to be insulting terms. The day after this party, my remorse was spectacular. I really just wanted to find a hole and crawl into it with the rest of the rats. I knew I had really done it.
but I was too locked up in this miserable little alcoholic trap. I was too involved in my own agony to tell my poor husband that I had disgraced and humiliated, that I was sorry. I thought he ought to know I was sorry. I thought he ought to know that no one would behave this way if he could help himself. I don't know whether he knew that or not, but he certainly knew after that party that I no longer drank because I had unresolved personality problems. I drank now because drinking had become my number one problem. Some weeks after this party, when I had recovered my stamina somewhat and was back on my usual schedule of things, I said to him in a very offhand way, did anybody ever get anything to eat the other night? He said, well, we shoveled it up off the floor. We got a little something on the table. Well, that was all right with a ham and a turkey, but it wasn't too good with Kent Newberg, really. You might imagine that in my life and circumstances, a performance like this would constitute what we call a bottom. But I didn't draw any such conclusion. I did conclude that something had to be done about the drinking, and I set out to do something about it with indifferent success, but more than I deserve, I'm sure. Only I don't recognize I don't recommend my system to anyone who's new and hasn't tried it. Because I learned some new things about loneliness. I thought I already knew what it was to be lonely. And the fact that I didn't have a good reason to be lonely, with a fine husband and two wonderful children, and what could have been an interesting life, the fact that I had these things and still felt as though I would die of loneliness, only convinced me that I was a freak, and reinforced all my feelings of failure and inadequacy. But after this party, the loneliness became morbid, because I had decided that I wouldn't do any drinking at all when other people were around. Now, I have always been a gregarious kind of person, and I am now. But before long, I didn't care very much about being with people anymore. I didn't want to plan to do things with the children in the evenings or during the weekends. And I didn't even care if my husband sat and talked with me after the children had gone to bed at night. I'd just say to him, oh, go on out in your study and play with your typewriter. And when I die, don't have anybody play the organ. Just have somebody play the typewriter, because that's the only thing I'm used to. In other words, all I wanted was for him to get the hell out and leave me alone to drink and tea. But of course, there wasn't any peace, because there isn't any peace in solitary confinement. And peace had made a prisoner of me. My chains may have been of the quake paper variety, but it is my experience that these are the most difficult ones for me to break. Now, thanks to AA, I'm not a prisoner anymore. I have a choice. I can take one drink with all its consequences, or I can do it the AA way and stay away from one drink for one day. I don't feel like a lost soul anymore, because my life has had some shape and some structure. I used to think that I had to have goals. I don't think I have to have goals anymore. I simply need a way to go. And my way is the way of the 12 steps and the 12 traditions. And these will lead me where I'm supposed to go if I'm faithful to them. Now, I not only can, but I do frequently fail miserably in the performance of my various duties and responsibilities. And I have bad days. But I've learned enough here to get up and go on again another day to start all over one more time. I'm easily discouraged, not as easily discouraged as I used to be. I fall into low spells, depressed periods, like everybody does. They don't last as long as they used to, and they're not as intense as they used to be, and they don't happen as often. But when I get this way, I fall into the old ways of thinking very quickly. I get very negative. I begin to slam the doors and slam the doors and kick the furniture and curse under my breath. And one day a number of years ago, I said out loud to myself,
If you sold yourself a bill of goods, what's so different about your life anyway? Except that you're sober. Except that I'm sober. When I came here, that's the only thing in the world that I was looking for, or even hoped to find, was sobriety. Everything else. Everything. This is David. I found here a new relationship with my husband and children, and a new interest and concern for their happiness and well-being. I found what it is to be a friend and to have a friend, and to be able to look at someone else and see that person, and not just a reflection of my own image there. I found that I could hold a responsible job, and as you know, I had one for a number of years that I really loved. I found new joy in the practice of my religion. And all of this is great. Because all I was looking for was sobriety. And if I want to know what it would be like to lose it, all I have to do is to remember those last 2 years when I drank alone late at night. And I can remember that I used to walk through the halls of my house and up and down the stairs. I was going for that one last drink. And I remember how I used to say to myself even then, oh, surely there must be some purpose in this. I must be looking for something that's missing from my life. And I know now that I was right about that. In my drunken confusion, I was right about that one thing. I was looking for something. And thanks be to God, I found it. I was looking for AA. I was looking for all of you. I was looking for the power greater than myself that I call God. Whenever I stand up in front of a room full of people like you and realize that all through that terrible time you were here and you had a vacancy, I see what a wasteland my pride and my willfulness and my blindness had made in my life. And I thank God I found you when I did. I'm not proud of these things that I've told you. None of us is proud. I spent years trying to forget things like this. But I know now that I must not ever forget. Lest I forget to be grateful to God for helping me to find AA. Lest I forget to be grateful to AA for helping me to find my life. Thank you.